Again, here we are, episode 118. Murph, we have 118. This is like surviving 118 attempts on our life. We have dodged all the bullets.
Nah, our listeners are loyal and they protect us.
You guys protect us. So welcome back again, episode 118, Game of Crimes. Thank you, thank you, thank you guys for joining. I am your host with the most hair. Just got it cut, Morgan Wright, here literally with my partner in crime.
Murph, who's almost bald, and your hair looks like crap.
My hair doesn't look like crap.
It looks like crap.
No, it doesn't. It looks marvelous. I've got so much. She says, the person who cut my hair said, when you come in after 6 weeks, it's like most people's 8 weeks or 10 weeks. So yeah. I get a lot of hair.
Hey, when I go in to get a haircut, it takes like 3 minutes. I'm in and out. There you go.
You sure that's a haircut?
Be nice now. I'm just starting this. Please don't pay attention to him, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
We're trying to get some professional help.
Yeah, whatever. All right. How's that working out for you? Okay. Let's just do some quick housekeeping before we get started. Hey, guys, head on over to that Apple Spotify. Hit those 5 stars. It helps us out a lot. Remember, the other thing we learned that too, guess what, guys? Not only did Stitcher go away, Google Podcasts is going away. So you're going to have to, if you're on Google, make sure you pick a new service to keep listening to us. Make sure you hit that subscribe button too, so that you do not miss delivered to your digital inbox every week on a Monday and Tuesday. These episodes like this one's coming out. Also head on over to our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. In fact, when we talk about our guest today, Mark Cameron, we'll talk about his book. That'll be listed on there. And we've got a lot of great stuff on there. So make sure you head on over there, gameofcrimespodcast.com. Also follow us on that thing they call social media, at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. But Murph, I'm telling you, we're going to have some fun on Patreon. Patreon.com/Game of Crimes. I have a 911 call coming up for you. Of all the 911 calls, I guarantee you nobody has taken a call like this before that I'm aware of ever anywhere. I'm
looking forward to hearing this one. Holy cow.
Oh, there's going to be a couple. This one, I don't know if I can make an entire case out of it, but it is good. I've listened to it, and just the sheer confusion on the call taker they've never been presented with this before. So we'll have to talk about that. But guys, we've also got, we just did our Warden of the Throne. It's a unique little thing we're doing now. Rather than just taking one topic, Murph brings two topics, I bring two topics. We're allowed to get into things that are catching our interest, you know, for the previous month or some stories. So we just did one talking about Philadelphia and the looting, Iran and what they call the Iranian Experts Initiative. People have had their security clearance suspended. You talk about some tragic cases up in New York, the Bronx, you know, baby dying. Center.
Yeah.
A daycare center, and the recent death of that CEO by a sexual predator who should have still been in prison but wasn't.
Right, in Baltimore.
So those are a lot of good things. We got Q&A coming up, 911, what's your emergency case of the month? So guys, all good stuff. You don't hear this anywhere else but on patreon.com/Game of Crimes. But the other place you got to be, though, too, Murph, our favorite mafia queen with the iron fist with the velvet glove. You got to head on over there, watch what Sandy Salvato is doing with our Game of Crimes fans page. Just go to Facebook, type in Game of Crimes fans, answer a couple easy questions, get admitted to the inner sanctum, and you too will see what goes on behind the scenes, behind the curtains. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, because that's one of our favorite people happening over on Game of Crimes fans.
It's a lot of fun. There's a lot of humor there.
A lot of dark humor, too. If you saw some of the stuff people have posted, I hope your healthcare plan supports you with an employee assistance program. I'm telling you.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Here's what I'm talking about. You know what I'm talking about now, because you know what time it is, don't you, Murph? You know what time? Guess what? I'm going to ask you, do you know what time it is? Guess what time it is? Come on, give me a clue.
It's time for Small Town Police Blotter.
Hey, this because in honor of our guest that's coming up, Mark Cameron, the author. We'll talk about him in a second, but he went from Texas, lives in Alaska. So I thought we should have an Alaska theme.
There you go.
For our Small Town Police Blotter. So Murph, got to ask you.
Yes.
This comes out of the Alaska Dispatch News.
Okay.
You know, a lot of fishery stuff, a lot of, you know, crabbing, a lot of lobster stuff. A lot of that goes on in Alaska, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have an idea. You go, hey, we're going to take a crabbing boat and we're going to convert it into a floating bar and strip club. What could go wrong, right?
Oh, my gosh.
So 54-year-old Darren Byler of Kodiak and his 46-year-old wife Kimberly own the Wild Alaskan, a former crabbing boat that's been converted into a floating bar and strip club. Apparently, it's doing pretty well. They've been running the business since June, but now they're in serious legal trouble. And Murph, it's not for stripping.
Uh-oh. What is it?
This gives new meaning to, you know, why this is on a crabbing boat. So if you're out there floating, you have to provide facilities for people to use, right?
Yeah.
So if they use the facilities, number one and number two, you should probably find a way to take care of that other than dumping it into the ocean.
Oh, come on.
So they were just indicted by a federal grand jury for improper disposal of human waste after they were caught dumping feces from their bathroom into the harbor, as they say in Maine, into the harbor. Instead of taking the waste tanks to the proper places on shore, they both could be facing up to 1 year in jail and $25,000 in fine. But that's not the worst part. The worst part is Coast Guard said they lied about dumping the tanks. And if they're convicted of that, making false statements to the Coast Guard investigators, that could get them 5 years in prison and $250,000 in fines.
Cha-ching.
I tell you what,
you got to do a lot of stripping to make that kind of money.
It's a shitty situation they found themselves in.
Yeah, it's terrible.
This
whole thing just stinks.
It stinks, man. Stinks to high heaven. Tell you what, you know, you had a turd in one hand and wishes in the other. Anyway, we could go lots of places with that. So
these people didn't move to Alaska from Florida, did they?
I don't believe so.
Thank goodness.
Hey, but I went back into the archives, too. So I pulled some articles out of the Alaska news archives, the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. This comes to us January 21st, 1955. And I'm telling you, the stories are hilarious. These are quick hits.
All right.
But this is what's in Alaska. This is what's important in Alaska, January of 1955. The Tokyo police hire pretty hostesses. Tokyo police, grieved by complaints that their headquarters is unattractive, have assigned four pretty girls to meet people at the building's two entrances. Officials have also ordered the women to take charm courses.
Okay.
That is what's important in the Alaska, you know, the Fairbanks.
Well, that wouldn't fly today. Well, that'd be
Daily News Miner, no. The other thing you got to do here, be prepared. And this comes to us. It's out of Tucson, Arizona, but in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. This is 1955. A 15-year-old boy with a loaded 38 caliber pistol in his waistband was removed from high school class here by police. His explanation for carrying a gun: a couple of those teachers were giving me a hard time.
What? Jeez. Okay.
Okay. But this one, though, this one has got to be this is it. This is a St. Boniface. I believe this is Alaska. No, Manitoba. This is St. Boniface, Manitoba.
All right.
Police were certain the worst of the winter is upon them. Pete Nikoluk has started his annual jail term for vagrancy. Nikoluk has spent the past 21 winters in jail on vagrancy charges. Police says he always manages to get arrested just before the coldest part of the winter sets in.
Who says this guy's not smart?
Three hots in a cot, and I get through the toughest part of winter.
Oh, my goodness. That's, that's prior planning, I guess.
Prior planning prevents piss-poor performance, the
there
six
you
P's.
Go. Yeah. You ask my children, they'll tell you what the six P's are.
That's right. Murph, now, we'll finish up with this. I went and looked at what are some of the strangest laws in Alaska, and these are definitely Alaskan. It is illegal to whisper in someone's ear while they are moose hunting.
Okay.
It's legal to shoot bears. However, it is illegal to wake a sleeping bear for the purpose of taking a photograph. Why would you wake a sleeping bear?
Isn't that the truth?
Here's another thing, and I don't get it. It is considered an offense. It's illegal to feed alcoholic beverages to a moose.
Well, why?
Apparently, it's also illegal to sell stun guns to children. That one, I kind of get that makes sense. Well, if you're in Fairbanks, Alaska, if you love a vuvuzela, remember what they did during the World Cup, you know, you blow those things that make a lot of noise.
Those annoying things?
Yeah, it's illegal to blow a horn in a manner that disrupts the peace.
Good.
Yep. So it's illegal to fatten up a sheep, cow, or pig within the city limits of Fairbanks.
Are we talking about people or animals? Sorry.
Well, maybe it's Meatball, and you'll have to listen to you'll have to listen to our Warden of the Throne. All right. It is also a crime to speak so loud that you offend a sensitive person enough to make him, her, or her leave if you're in Fairbanks. What?
Okay. Well, hey, be nice. That's just be nice.
And you can only carry a concealed slingshot if you have received the appropriate license. The license. Do you have a license for that slingshot? All right.
Oh, okay. I didn't know you had to have that. But
Murph, this is the craziest one. This reminds me of an episode of you and JP on Narcos where you were accused of doing this. Not a moose, but it is an offense to push a live moose out of a moving airplane.
Well, you know, I got to agree with that. But have you seen how big a moose is? How do you push it anywhere?
Well, how do you get it into the damn airplane to begin with is what I want to know.
And who wants a moose, a pissed off moose in their airplane?
Uniquely Alaskan. So, Mark Cameron, as we get into this, and again, we want to thank our buddy Patrick O'Donnell, Cops and Writers. Yes. Go listen to his podcast. Hooked us up with him, but Mark Cameron is an interesting dude, moved from Weatherford, Texas to Alaska, and we're going to talk about his book that was just released. It's an Arliss Cutter novel, Breakneck, by Mark Cameron. But the interesting thing too, Murph, was he wrote the last 7 Tom Clancy novels, and this is a guy that used to be a marshal, which most of their reports were saw bad guy, put him in jail. You know, not extensive reports in the marshal service.
Saw fugitive, arrested same.
J.D. Yeah, Buck Savage will have on there.
I tell you, when Patrick told us about this guy, you know, and we do our own little research and vet him, but Patrick's, if he vets him and approves him, that's pretty much good for us because he does a fantastic job. But looking at Mark's background and seeing, I was a Tom Clancy fan back when Tom Clancy was still writing the books, and to see that he had picked that up, and he's going to tell you how that all happened and what's going on with that. But then to see how he's blossomed into other things, he's got 2 other series that are just phenomenal. And I think the reason I'm gushing on this a little bit is because I love to see what law enforcement professionals do after they retire from law enforcement. And even though he's retired, he's not locking people up anymore. He still supports law enforcement in Alaska, and you'll hear him talk about that a little bit as well. So just have the utmost respect for him. I don't have the writing skills to write a book. I don't think I tried writing our book one time and wrote for 6 hours, waited 2 days, read it, and thought, what a bunch of crap.
Because it read like a cable.
It read like a primer for elementary kids. It was terrible. So,
well, you can find him at Mark, M-A-R-C, Mark Cameron, C-A-M-E-R-O-N, markcameronbooks.com. But Murph, here's the other thing too. I don't know if you look through the back of the book. The other thing he provides too is he's got a couple recipes in there. Grumpy's dessert beans, a savory dish, but when Ethan and Arliss were young, they craved them like a dessert. So he gives you recipes by his character, and Ritz cracker fried halibut.
Well, there you go. Hey, see, this is an educational program we have here.
You know why he wrote the book? Just for the halibut.
Oh my gosh. And we can't even edit that out. That was actually funny.
But look, again, this is great stuff. He was a writer all of his life. He finally is able now to spend full time doing his passion. But he has got some funny stories that we talk about. And if you want to know something that's really Alaskan, wait till you hear a couple of these stories. But Murph, we will never hear him unless I ask you. Are you ready to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous, and if you're in Alaska, coldest, and watch out for moose, game of all, game of crimes?
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, get in, sit down, shut up, hold on. You're going to hear about some adventures here that you're probably not expecting. So bring on Mr. Mark Cameron.
So I've learned not to use Spanish or any other foreign languages because that seems to trigger the ads. So we're just going to stick to English for this one, or say maybe Russian this time. Очень приятно, товарищ. Ну, по-русски? Yeah? Okay.
¿Qué pasó? Oh, now you're going to get Russian and
Spanish. ¿Qué pasó, comrade? So, hey, guys, welcome. We got another special guest. This one is special in a variety of ways. First of all, he comes from us, former U.S. Marshal. But the dude is turned into an author extraordinaire, and we're going to talk to that. We're going to talk about what he's done. So first of all, his nom de guerre, his pen name, we welcome him as Mark Cameron. Welcome to Game of Crimes Podcast, Deputy Marshal.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate he didn't even know how to respond to that. You left him speechless.
Well, as long as he doesn't have to worry about speaking because he writes, and he writes really well. So, hey, Mark, first of all, welcome. This is fun too, because right before we got started, we're talking about mutual friend we have, Ryan Steck, and talking about a lot of the work that you guys have all done in the thriller space. And it's interesting, though. We're going to get into this, but Ryan said, hey, make sure you bring this up, because I read it on his website. You had the distinction of writing how many Tom Clancy novels? Seven?
Seven.
Seven or
yeah,
eight?
I did.
Seven?
I just turned in the seventh, which will be my last one. I've asked him to find somebody else. That's a lot of bandwidth for an old dude like
well,
me.
Well, so that's interesting. So they got a couple of guys who write novels together as a team to take over for you. But you've got – look, I got to tell you, I started off on Tom Clancy. I was one of the original people that read Hunt for Red October, published by the Naval Press. And I was in an airport one day, and I picked it up, and I read it. You know, so the fact that you got to – you know, right in that legacy, man. That is a badge of honor, especially as we were talking for a U.S. Marshal whose reports barely used to be a paragraph when you were booking people into jail, right?
No, I was in the police academy in Texas in 1984 when The Hunt for Red October came out, and I wanted to be a writer from the time I was a little boy. And in fact, I told my wife before we got married, when I was courting her, that I was going to be a novelist and a theater professor at a college, and she decided, yeah, I want to do that. And then right like 6 weeks before we got married, I sprung it on her that I really want to be a cop and a novelist, and she married me anyway. But so I got a job at a little police department, and during that first year I was a police officer, I read The Hunt for Red October. So when the offer came up to write for the Clancy's estate, I nearly had an aneurysm. It was out of the blue. Had no idea it was coming, but I've been a Clancy fan since Clancy published his first book.
You know, and it's amazing too, because he almost didn't get it published. I think he went to 25 places, and it took the Naval Press to publish Hunt for Red October. And then here's an insurance salesman. He did his research. One thing that was so good about it, he did his research. But let's go back to you, talking about you growing up in this thing of ours. What made you decide? Go ahead.
Just before you start that, we've got to give a shout out to the person who introduced us.
Oh,
to Mark,
okay.
And that's Patrick O'Donnell, who is a former guest on Game of Crimes, but also has his own podcast, Cops and Writers. So, Patrick, and this is not the first person you've recommended for us, and we expect this to be a home run just like all the others. No pressure, Mark. But thank you, brother.
Yeah. Well, Patrick's a good dude.
Absolutely.
Patrick is a good guy. Very good guy.
Well, and Patrick, I will never mispronounce you again. I introduced him accidentally as Patrick O'Connell one time. I said, we're just going to change your name. But his mother's going to kick my ass, so it's Patrick O'Donnell.
He's going to send Peaky Blinders over here to take you out.
Peaky Blinders. We went through the Peaky Blinders. Well, hey, so which part of Texas did you grow up in?
Little town called Weatherford, just out of Fort Worth. You know, it's one of those towns that's got a lot of history. If you've ever seen the show Lonesome Dove, you ever watch that show?
Yeah. Robert Duvall, my wife loves that. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, yeah. Well, I was a mounted policeman with Weatherford for a number of years, and I was riding horses while that was on. And, of course, that was back during the days when you couldn't TiVo anything or stream it, so we would like work our schedule around, because to us Lonesome Dove was a training video. So we would be home watching Lonesome Dove, but Weatherford has Parker County. If you remember in Lonesome Dove, Woodrow Call brings Gus McCrae back and buries his body underneath. I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but buries his body and, you know, hauls him all the way across down from Montana all the way back down to in the show San Antonio. But that's based on a historical event, the Goodnight Loving Trail, and Charles Goodnight brought Oliver Loving's body after he had to have his arm cut off, got blood poisoning, all that from an Indian attack, brought his body back to Parker County and buried him under a little pecan tree in a little cemetery there. So a lot of history.
Well, Robert Duvall lives not too far from me out here in Northern Virginia, Loudoun County. We actually ran into him at Fireworks Pizza in Leesburg, giving those guys a shout out. I had a unique connection, not anything from me, but my grandfather was an old timer, lived in Colorado. Well, they were getting extras for the movie True Grit with John Wayne. He is one of the old timers sitting in the chair in Ouray, Colorado, rocking back and forth when Ned Pepper, Robert Duvall, rides into town. So he's got his 15 seconds of fame on the screen. You can see him as one of the old timers there. And we ran into him over here.
That is also a training video. In fact, we'd go to the mall and show that little scene, the big, I call that bold talk for one-eyed fat man scene. And every time there'd be all the noise going on in the mall and the Marshal Service's recruiting and all that. And all these kids would be walking by and covering up everything until John Wayne says, "Fill your hand, you son of a bitch." And then everything would get quiet and all the ladies would look at me. And, yeah.
And then he puts those brains between his teeth and gets that repeating rifle. And yeah.
Yep,
oh, one of the exactly. great. Oh, man. Oh, I'm already getting goosebumps. This is going to be fun. All right. So actually, a good friend of mine, too, just retired as the chief of police there in Grand Prairie. But I used to come down to – he used to ride the bulls and did the bareback bronc riding at the there in Fort Worth in the stockyards.
Oh,
back
yeah.
in the day.
Yeah.
That's where he met his wife. Yeah. So why did you start – so you started off mounted patrol. Did you have the big white Stetson, too?
Black.
Oh, Black that had to get Stetson. Hot during the
yeah,
summer.
Yeah, we were – well, we wore straw hats in the summer, but I started on patrol, started as the regular patrol officer, and there was a detective for a number of years. And then the mounted patrol came up, and I wasn't a very good rider. I enjoy riding, but I was a horseshoer, and the city saw that they could get their horses shod cheap if they had one of their guys do it. So they let me on the patrol because I could shoe their horses. Now,
did you grow up on a ranch in Texas? Is that how you knew how to do that?
No, I just enjoy. We had like 10 acres, and I really didn't start cowboy until I was older, till I was like in my early 20s. Had friends, and I just enjoyed that, and kind of learned as I went along.
It's like they say on the show Yellowstone: everybody wants to be a cowboy till it's time to do cowboy shit.
Yeah, exactly. hardest work I've ever done was horseshoeing, and the strongest I've ever been. You don't stand statically with a 900-pound animal leaning on you for, hours at a time when not get – it was getting paid to go to the gym, now, that's for sure.
Did you get bit a couple times or get kicked?
Oh, I got kicked, got some nails driven. Always for stupid stuff I've done, but I got plenty of scars.
I just love those horses, man. They're such great animals. My dad before he passed away, we all went out and visited out in Gunnison, Colorado. He used to have a horse out there, Boulder Jack. My sister ended up with him, and just the horse. It's just so much fun watching those folks do that, and especially Texas. But around, Steve, you were telling me one time you're talking to a guy from Texas. Unless it's like 10,000 acres, it's not a ranch in Texas.
Yeah, we were down in Victoria, Texas. My old DEA partner Javier Pena and I speaking to a group, and part of it is we show the famous ranch that Pablo Escobar had down in Colombia, Finca Napolis. And I made the statement. I said, we've heard it's anywhere from 1,000 to 10,000 acres. What it doesn't matter to us, because that's huge. And so when we finished talking, the sheriff came up to thank us for coming. He said, and Murph, I guess just got to tell you, you mentioned that a ranch between 1,000 and 10,000 acres is huge. Well, here in Texas, we call that a ranchette. So, I don't know how many acres he owned, but apparently a whole lot more.
That is absolutely true. The flip side of that is on some of those places down near Victoria and, South Texas and in West Texas, it takes 100 acres to run one cow-calf pair. So you need that to run – you need 10,000 acres to run 100 cattle. So it just takes a lot to support some cows.
And cowboying's become fashionable now with Yellowstone and stuff like that. So, and then one of the characters out of Yellowstone ended up going down – what was it, the – I forgot the name of the ranch. It's like the 888 or whatever else he's doing cowboying.
4-6.
4-6. Yeah.
4-6s.
Yeah. Doing some cowboying down there in Texas. Season 5 of Yellowstone.
Jimmy. Jimmy went down there.
Season 5 is coming out. So I think end of the month. So yeah. We'll have to do about this. So how big was your department? How many people on your department? How big was your town when you were doing this?
Small, like 40 people altogether. It was very small. Very small. Weatherford, it's grown now. It's a much bigger department now. But when I started, there was, three officers on midnight shift, some deputy sheriffs on midnight shift, and the troopers. And there was that hierarchy, the county mounties and the city kiddies and the highway patrol. But I was a young kid. I was barely old enough to buy my own bullets when I got on, barely 21 years old.
Murph couldn't even buy bullets when he got on.
I started at 19. I couldn't buy a gun or bullets, but I could shoot your ass.
Wowzer. Isn't that awesome? Yeah, exactly. Well, it was a different time. I think you and I started close to the same time. I started in 84. Yeah, you're a little ahead of me.
I started in 82, and he started in what? I started in 82, time. And you started in what, right after 1776, wasn't it?
1883. That's the first episode of the Yellowstone series.
Yeah, you see Murph in the background with Tim McGraw. Hey, I'm City Marshal here.
I have my repeating rifle out there. I can fly that thing around.
Yeah, exactly. My son always, was APD. He's State Department now, but he was Anchorage Police Department. And he would joke that, you know, he'd see my pictures of me with my 686 revolver and some speed loaders, and, you know, they're carrying Glock 22s, and just a different world. Just a completely different world.
I'd been a cop for 12 years before I went to DEA, and even when I went through the DEA Academy in 1987, they were still issuing the Smith & Wesson Model 10 revolvers. I'm like, damn, even we've got better guns.
Yeah, I went through the Marshals in 91. Yeah. I went through the Marshals in 91, and we got GP100 Rugers. They were like, great gun, but as soon as everybody went home, they got a semi-auto. Except for me, I got a 44 Special because I thought I was
cool. You'd watch True Grit too many times. Yeah, that was my first. I started off on a City Department, but I went to the State Patrol, that's what we had, Smith & Wesson 686s. Those were, I mean, I love that thing. Nice, solid weapons.
Gun.
Yeah.
Excellent gun.
Oh, yeah. It was like a combination revolver and big steel pipe you could whack people with that got unruly, right?
You know, saves on bullets. You know, bullets are expensive.
Only bad guys. Only bad guys. It was what was that Arnold Schwarzenegger says in True Lies? He says, yes, but they were all bad. It was a different time.
Yeah, I just saw that bridge too. We were just down in the Keys for vacation, and you know, the highway that they blew up for True Lies is down there. Anyway, I digress. But you were on the PD. So what made you, but during this time, you said you wanted to be a novelist. What started that? Was it just from reading? Did you like to read a lot back then? Or how did this idea of being a novelist, and then obviously you got out of the theater because you came a cop, but how did the idea of novelists creep into your psyche back as a youth like that?
So I started writing stories and books when I was about 8. So I've got piles and piles and piles. My mom has piles and piles of spiral notebooks and steno pads and whatever scraps of paper I could write. And, you know, I try to keep those under wraps. I don't want those ever getting out. But when we first got married, that little department I started at, I was making $6.67 an hour. And we had to buy our own gun. We bought our own leather. And back in, you guys remember, in the early 80s, they didn't buy you, most departments wouldn't buy you a ballistic vest. And, you know, and DuPont Kevlar was relatively new
and rigid.
So that first year, because my wife knew that I had this dream, my wife knew that I had these dreams of being an officer and, you know, a police officer and also being a writer. And the first year on a meager salary, somehow she scraped together enough money to buy me an American Body Armor ballistic vest, that kind with the armadillo on it with a bullet ricocheting off his back. And there was no cover. It was just the vest. And when you needed to wash it, you had to like hold it underwater. And in Texas, well, they could get pretty ripe. But so she bought me an American Body Armor vest and a Smith Corona electric typewriter that very first year. And I'd been writing most stuff longhand or on an old typewriter I got from my parents, a manual one. And I wrote stories and got rejection letters for years. And I remember I sold a short story and Hemingway would send his stuff off, drink all day and then get a rejection letter and then just go to sleep weeping. And then the next day he'd send something off and do it again. Well, I didn't drink all day and go to bed weeping. I had a job to do, but I kept writing, and I got a lot of rejection letters. And finally, I was with the Marshal Service and I came home one day and my wife had a rolled up newspaper or magazine in her hand and a check for like $700. And she said, this is where, you know, again, we're like 23 years in of just rejection letters. And she still, that was my hobby, just writing. And she swatted me on the butt with that magazine and she said, "This is working out. Now go write us a new couch."
And you so gotta love it.
I just kept at it.
Go write us a new couch.
God. Well,
so I was writing when I was with the police department all the time, just never getting posted.
Well, I guess what I'm doing right now, because Mama wants a new car, we're our speaking business. I guess we're speaking for a new car.
That's it. I like it. Hey, that's it.
I'm going to ask you, when you had to write an offense report, did you have a sergeant or somebody come up and says, "Hey, Mark, just knock this shit off. Just give me a simple report. I don't need a novel." Were you writing novels for your narratives?
No, I think I can figure out how to do it a little differently than that. I did have one. Remember when we carried the old PR-24s? Yep. And I was a PR-24 instructor, the side-handled baton. And back when I first started and on into the beginning of the Marshal Service, we had to write three-part triplicate, you know, reports. And we wrote them like you guys. I mean, I think everybody did back then, except for the really big departments. We printed them on these three-part with carbon paper in the middle and all that. And so the problem with that is they can't just line correct 20, you know, change this or change that. You have to rewrite the whole thing or white out each individual page or whatever the offense report. And I remember I had you couldn't really sit down very well with a PR-24 and that little ring. So I would take it out, set it on the squad room table, and I had it sitting there and I was writing my report out. And the sergeant didn't even read it. He just came by, and I was almost finished with this full-page narrative. And he came by and picked up my PR-24 like a hammer and just went all over the top of it. So it looked like a Dalmatian dog all over the thing. And I said, "What did you do that for, and Sarge?" And he said, "Well, I knew it'd be bad. Just start over. It'd be bad." So I had good trainers. I had really good trainers.
You have a description for the PR-24, don't you?
I do too, man. I learned this from some guys in LAPD. So why do they have the side handle on the PR-24? So when the bad guy takes it from you and shoves it up your ass, it only goes about 6 inches.
Yeah, but on bump. Exactly.
And then they were giving us, then they went to polycarbonate ones. It's like, we got to be smaller and lighter. It's like, we had a guy one night at a truck stop, just had that, you know, that 1,000-yard stare. You knew it was going to be a problem. And we found out later, we didn't know, thank God, at the time, this guy was former Special Forces, Green Beret. He could have probably killed both of us with just his pinky finger. And I remember he went to take a fighting stance, and I struck him with the baton on the side of the arm. He didn't flinch, and my baton went flying away about 10 feet, you know, 15, 20 feet or whatever. And he looked at me and he says, "You know, this could go really bad, but I'm just going to let you arrest me." And we went, oh, I wasn't Catholic, but I said, oh, thank God, you know, because this guy had that look, you know.
Yep, I think everybody, you know, and there were times when they were great, but I had a similar experience where I had a guy had two other officers down. One was laying across, and it was just a fight. It wasn't planning on killing them, but one was on all fours, just kind of falling over, and the other one was had kind of landed splayed out on a picnic table in the park. So I arrived, pulled out the PR-24, snuck it behind him, and the guy was. He was kind of leaning on his hands and knees, kind of with his hands on his knees. And I snuck it behind him and gave him what seemed to me to be the perfect power swing, you know, where you use the side handle and you smack it in there. And instructors could quote how many foot pounds were per square inch, whatever. And I hit him right in the common peroneal, you know, where you give a dead leg. And he turned around and looked at me and said, "What do you want?" And I thought, okay, we're going to guns because this guy's way bigger and he's already knocked two officers out. And then he gave up like you know, we could fight all night. But one of the things I noticed is that when I look back at my career where I worked, kind of in the edge of the oil patch there in cowboy country, everybody fought, but very few people wanted to take it any farther. You know, if your gun fell out, they'd kick it out of the way and continue to, there were some really bad guys, but it seemed like everybody had to be bloodied before they would go to jail. It was just a different mentality from that side of the, you know, It was just, it was interesting.
When I was a city officer and a state trooper, I was out in Southwest Kansas, and we had a lot of farm boys. You know, they'd come in, they'd Thursday night, Friday night, want to go drinking and stuff. And it was kind of one of those things, you get called to a bar fight, and it's kind of like, I'm not running lights and sirens. We just slow down, we get there. By the time we get there, we don't see anything. It's like, okay, you guys, just go home or, you know, have a beer. And that was it most of the time. The only time you took somebody to jail is when they didn't get the message, like, you need to go now. And they'd go, well, fuck you, I'm not leaving. Well, you are now, you know, so... Hey, but what I was going to ask you, how long were you on the city before you went to the Marshals, and why did you pick the Marshals? Did you think about going to another federal agency? What was the impetus to say go from Weatherford to now the U.S. Marshals, or was there a stop in between?
No, I went. It took about 2.5 years, but I'd wanted to be a deputy since I was quite young, and I was in high school, and I actually was good friends with a son of a deputy marshal, but I didn't really know his dad was a deputy. He was always off doing stuff and, you know, arresting bad guys around. He worked out of the Fort Worth office, and Weatherford's about 35, 40 minutes west of Fort Worth. And, but I remember being about 14 or 15 years old, and Weatherford's one of those old, Parker County is one of those old places with the courthouse square and the big green courthouse green. So, you know, kind of a traffic circle around, and then a big green around it, and then parking meters all around. And I remember crossing from one of the little stores to a cafe there. So this would have been like back in 1976, 75 or 76. And this pickup pulled up in front of one of the parking meters, and this tall, lanky dude got out with a nice Stetson, and he had a starch shirt and starch jeans and his, you know, no jacket, just a gun with a big old Silver Star badge. And he took a canvas bag with a metal collar on it, and he put it over the parking meter and locked it up. And it said, official business, U.S. Marshal. So we didn't have to pay the dime, right? And I thought right then when I was 14, I want one of those bags. I want me one of those bags someday. So I'm going to have to be a deputy marshal. And then as I grew up and, you know, I mean, watched True Grit and, you know, the old West Marshal. Of course, that's where I grew up, is that, you know, part of the world. So the Marshals were, they were cool people. I didn't really know what they did. Then once I got on with the department and I saw, and not to speak ill of any other agency, but there is an agency that will really want to have, you know, they really want to be there when you make the arrest. There's a lot of, you know, just as a bureaucracy, they were great guys, men and women to work with. But when the Marshals called and said, hey, we need help arresting this guy, if you see him, get him. There was no, it was more about the outcome, more about getting the bad guy in jail. Every time we worked with the Marshals, it was a pleasure. And they would swoop in. I mean, to us, it was like they came down off Mount Olympus and dealt with us.
We all know who you're talking. You know, we all know who you're talking.
Yeah,
about.
Let's don't mention the. Don't mention the FBI here.
And I've got lots of friends with the bureau. I really do. But the Marshals were just. They were just, and the work was fun. I mean, I knew going in that there was going to be a lot of sitting in court. I knew there was going to be transporting prisoners and all that. But I'm the kind of guy that likes a little thinking time because I'm a writer. So sitting in court or taking a long, you know, hamburger marshal prisoner trip is not a bad thing for me because I get to do the quote unquote sexy stuff with fugitive work. And so when the time came, and you guys remember, I'm sure you do, we would, before the internet, we would all order our pamphlets from whatever agency. And I got them from everybody. I even got them from the North Slope Borough of Alaska, because I thought, well, I'm going to go up and be an Alaska state trooper because I want adventure. But Alaska wouldn't hire anybody unless you lived here for a year and had residency. So I was going to go up and work the very top of Alaska, that North Slope. So I get pamphlets from them, pamphlets from the DEA, pamphlets from the ATF and the Marshals. And we would pull up at night on night shift, pull up, you know, door to door, so we could pass pamphlets back and forth. And, hey, what have you got? Have you filled out an application for these guys? What are you hearing back from the Border Patrol? And it was a small department. We got paid, you know, we progressed and we're making decent livings. But I would say probably maybe a quarter of the people that worked with me went to other agencies, the Bureau, the Border Patrol, the Marshal Service, U.S. Customs. DEA wouldn't have any of us, dang it.
Did anybody go to the Kansas Highway Patrol?
No. But I did have a Kansas Highway Patrol officer come work for me in Alaska, cool, in the Marshal Service. He came from
and
them
if
to
I
me.
If I remember, I think I know who you're talking about. That wasn't one of the two that was killed in the plane accident, was he?
No. This one came to work. This guy's name's Ryan Filson. He came up here from, he was Kansas Highway Patrol and worked with DHS, Health and Human Services, maybe. He was an OIG investigator. And then came, I recruited him to come work for us. Good guy.
Well,
great guy.
Murph's just jealous because one of the guys that, quote, caught El Chapo the first time, he couldn't get on the Kansas Highway Patrol, but he got on DEA. So we did have standards, apparently, DEA did. But
hey, we have standards. They might be a little low.
Very low.
We have standards.
Hey, but Mark, you brought up a really good point, though, too. And it was always my experience working with the marshals on cases or even the Bureau and other guys. We always got along at the field agent level, you know, at the agent level. Most people wanted to do stuff. It's when you got into the politics, you know, the supervisory level, people worried about, well, who's going to put out the press release? And guys that were like you or I, me out there, feet on the street that just wanted to go make the arrest, nobody gave a shit. We're like, I don't care who puts out the press release. We all wanted to go have a beer afterwards.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the – and especially in places that are far-flung, Alaska is – you know, it's like this with families. If your in-laws and outlaws don't live up here, then – neighbors get together for Thanksgiving, and in the law enforcement, it's kind of the same way because there's no one else to call. We're, you know, 1,000 miles away from Seattle, so you don't call another SWAT team if you need FBI HRT. You know, we'll see you tomorrow, kind of a thing, and so everybody has to handle it. So my youngest son was on the SWAT team here in Anchorage for a number of years, and they just had to handle stuff themselves because that was where the buck stopped. And you guys know that standoffs and hostage situations and things like that, they don't last long enough to get help oftentimes from a neighboring big city in the lower 48. So, troopers, Anchorage police, marshals, FBI, DEA, everybody really worked, very closely together. One of my really good friends in federal law enforcement system is a DEA, he's a retired DEA agent. We work closely together as well. In fact, he's helped me. I won't name him, but he's helped me quite a bit on some of the Clancys. The very first Clancy that I know we'll get into this in a minute, but since we're talking to other agencies and DEA, he had heard through the grapevine at one of the Northern Knives it's a knife shop here in town that we all frequent, and this guy came in and he goes, "Hey, I heard you're doing one of the you're writing the next Tom Clancy." And I said, "I am." And he goes, "Well, remember that show? Remember that book Without Remorse, and how John Clark put the guy in the decompression chamber?" He goes, "I was at the place where we burn up all our the narcotics, the incinerator, and it's got this conveyor belt. I was thinking that would be a cool place for John Clark." And I said, "Let's go." And so we went to this field trip to the incinerator. And if you read Power and Empire, it's got two dedicated chapters to that incinerator because of my DEA friend and his imagination. Hey,
you were talking to, I had a chance at one of the International Association of Chiefs of Police Conference, IACP, to meet the commissioner of the Alaska State Troopers. And so we had a couple good chats and stuff because it was funny. Some guys from Kansas went up there. Some other folks went up there because it became very popular. Remember, Nat Geo did, you know, Alaska State Troopers, you know, be on TV. People thought, oh, that's pretty cool. Except you get people up there and they realize, hey, yeah, you want to be in Anchorage or one of those, that's fine, but you got to go be a resident trooper. You got to be in one of these small little villages with the VSPO, the village VPSO, Village Public Safety. You got to be VPSO, way up there for like 2 years or 3 years before you can come back to civilization. And it was a culture shock. It was a culture shock for many of these guys who were used to having a Starbucks on the corner.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Who was the commissioner?
I just got to think of his name. He had dark,
remember his name?
He had dark hair and a mustache and glasses. I'm trying to think of his name.
Was it a long time ago?
Like 6-7 years ago, maybe 8 years ago.
Joe Masters.
That sounds Joe Masters. Familiar. I'd have to see the picture.
Maybe.
But yeah, but he had like a dark mustache. And
yeah. No. Though they're kind of stocky. Good. Yeah. Yeah, he's a good guy. He's a friend of mine as well. Yeah, everybody's pretty close up here. But working the bush, we call it places you can't get to except by plane, boat, or birth canal, the bush. So if you have to work out in one of these villages, I love the villages. I just love the rural aspect of it. I love the cultures and the people. And there's a lot of crime out there is any place that's cut off. I mean, people sometimes blame the crime on culture or even mistakenly race, because it's predominantly Alaska Natives. But the same issues are in Appalachia or any place where there's poverty and isolation. And so those bush troopers, and they're predominantly newer in their career, young men and women, and my hat is off to them. They're just doing the Lord's work out there. And you can really tell the places where they're working and working hard, the people that the community just really gets behind them and loves them. I just came back from one. So they're neat places to go, and very old style law enforcement. It's that one riot, one ranger, because ain't nobody coming to help you. And these are the kind of places where, you know, village health aides who basically have the EMT level might have to get on a sat link with a doctor and do some operation on the cafeteria table because there's nobody coming to help. So you have either that person's going to die, or we're going to cut him open with this sharpened knife because it's too icy to get in on the river. You know, it's frozen, half frozen, half melted, so you can't take a boat, and it's too cloudy to get a plane, which means
wow,
there's nobody coming for sometimes days.
If you spit on the knife and rather,
which I love,
drive it under your armpit, that's sanitary, right?
Yeah. And folks, you're going to notice we have just a little bit of a lag. One of the reasons is I'm in Virginia, Murph's in Florida, and where are you at, Mark? It takes a while for the internet to get there. Where are you at?
I'm in Anchorage, Alaska. Yeah, like I said, we use two tin cans and a string.
So we apologize. There's like, we may step on each other because there's like just a little bit of a lag, but we'll try and do our best. But let's kind of circle back now, because I want to move us forward through your career, getting into Marshals, talk about a couple things you did, and then get into the writing. But you said it took you 2.5 years to get on the Marshals?
Yes. Yeah, it was a time when they were... Well, even now, it's really hard to get on the Marshals. It's just the hiring process is kind of convoluted, and maybe just with all the federal agencies. But we took a test, and then you waited to hear by mail for a couple of months to hear what your test. Well, first you had to send a little blue sheet of paper saying, I want to take a test. And then you heard by mail a couple of months later when your test date was. And then I drove over to Fort Worth or Dallas and took the test, which at that time was the Treasury Enforcement Agents exam. So there was algebra on it, which is my kryptonite. So you had, you know, memory, you know, look at the picture of the American flag and the people and walking. And then you took a math test and then came back and they asked you a bunch of questions about that picture of the post office and which way the flag was blowing and all that. So, took that test 2 months later. 2 or 3 months later, you got back the results of the test. And then they said, okay, you're on a list. And then about a year later, you got a letter in the mail saying, we want to bring you in for an interview. And by the way, if you don't get this job off this interview, it'll expire and you have to start over again. And so I thought I had really given up because I had an interview. It seemed very positive. And then I pretty much gave up after almost 2 years and started sort of reassessing what I was going to do. And I'd applied with some other places too. That's when I applied with the North Slope Borough up here, which is the top quarter of Alaska, is one giant municipality. And I had and then I got a call that, hey, we've had a young lady break her leg at FLETC, at Federal Law Enforcement Training Academy. Would you be ready to go next Monday? And I said, absolutely, I'll be ready to go. And so I told my wife, I think we're going. And then, I got a call and said, oh, sorry, her leg's not broken. It's just sprained. We're good to go.
Oh,
don't call us. We'll call you. And then I waited about another 8 months. And, but it was after that I should have expired, you know, my application should have expired, but because they had kind of hired me and then kind of let me go, I guess they felt sorry for me because, I was out working on a barn, the horse barn, and my, you know, mounted police stuff. And my wife came, and we had been, my wife knew a lady with the Marshal Service HR named Mary Cassidy, who would, she's the one we would call, say any status, you know, what's going on. And my wife would call her like once every 2 months. And so Mary like recognized my wife's voice on the phone and sorry, it's not going on. So my wife came screaming up. We had three little kids at the time and she came screaming up in the truck and slid to a stop and jumped out. Mary Cassidy called, you're starting. And so I like dropped my welding hat and headed to the truck and gave him 2 weeks notice and moved to Sherman, Texas for, well, I started in Dallas to process in, went to, we affectionately call it FLETEC, Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. And then my first office was in Sherman for the Eastern District of Texas, but really north of Dallas.
So how far is Weatherford from Sherman? I mean, was it a big move for you or just like, what, a couple hours?
Yeah, about 4 hours, maybe. Yeah, and my wife actually, so we had two kids, but she was pregnant when I went to Glencoe to the train, to the Marshals Academy. And I was out on a fun run. They call it those voluntary mandatory evening, you know, 10Ks that they would do. And so running through the Georgia woods in this golf cart and one of the armored limos that we used for training, we're on a cadence run, and it pulled up beside me and said, "Fall out and you're having a baby." And so I got in and I drove, you know, they drove me back to building 20 and let me talk to my wife. And she had had our son, our youngest son that day, the one that's now a police officer. And then I talked to her for about 5 minutes and they said, "So you're quitting?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm only a month in. I knew this was happening." And they said, "All right." And then they drove me back out to the run and I finished the run. And then luckily that was around President's Day. So I got to go home and see the kid. But while I was in the academy, so then I had 3 more months to go to the academy. And while I was there, my wife took the new baby and the two older kids and loaded a U-Haul. And so I'm kind of a jerk for, I mean, I feel like a jerk for having her do this while I was gone. But when I got home, she was already, I mean, I flew back. I never touched down in Weatherford. I flew into Dallas and went to my new house that my wife had all fixed up. And yeah, she was.
That's a good woman.
Stellar.
That's a good woman.
Getting everything moved.
I was going to say, I bet your neighbors love you. Is this the dude absolutely. Who made you, while you had a brand new baby, pack the house and move while he's off? Oh, man.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I get that a lot. I wrote some, I can't remember what, crime scenes. It's a magazine. I'm going to be in trouble for not remembering who I wrote it for, but I wrote a little article telling some of these stories, and the only comment on the article was, "What an asshat." I thought, "Oh yeah, I guess I kind of am. I didn't mean to be." I didn't like, you know, crack a whip, but she's just a great.
She knows how to
friend.
Take care of business.
Really helped out over the years,
which seems to be common amongst law enforcement
wives. She does. She does. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. You have to.
Interesting
be, I think.
Observation. I wanted to ask you about this too. You were in Texas, big grand Texas. You know, nice and hot. What was the fascination about the North Slope of Alaska? I mean, there could not be more two entirely different environments.
Well, it's interesting you ask that, but it has to do with literature, has to do with books. I read Jack London as a kid. I read a book by a Canadian author named Farley Mowat. Some people, you know, he's written a lot of books, kind of environmentalist guy. In fact, I think he was banned from the United States for a while because he threatened to shoot down some F-16s or something over acid rain back in the 80s. But he wrote a book called Two Against the North about two boys that got stranded in the barren lands of Canada. And I read it when I was about 11, 12 years old, I guess about 10, and just fell in love with the North. But my wife's Canadian. I had to, you know, marry a Canadian girl. I love the North so much. But I read this when I was quite young, and it was about hunting caribou and native cultures and living off the land. And these boys have to survive for most of a winter. And they find out that if you stare at the snow for very long in the bright lights, that you're going to go snow blind. That's really hard on your eyes. And so they carve these little snow goggles, these Inuit snow goggles, so they could keep from getting snow blind. And so as a 10 or 11 year old boy, I got a cottonwood root out of our backyard and carved me some snow goggles and wore them around. I think my dad thought I was pretty tetched. You know, something's wrong with this Texas kid wearing these snow goggles around. And then it was, I mean, I was weird, but I just always had a fascination with the North Country. And so we did our time in Texas, and I love Texas. I love the people, but I also love the mountains and the sea. And so we did our time in Texas with the PD and the Marshal Service, and then I put in for a spot in North Idaho in Coeur d'Alene, and we were in Coeur d'Alene for 4 years, inching our way north, and then right along the border there. And then when an opening came up in Alaska, I moved to Anchorage in 98. So about 8 years into my career, 7 years
into
my career.
When you were in Coeur d'Alene, we know that there was some activity. Wasn't it the Weaver, trying to think, Randy Weaver, some of the stuff tied to the Oklahoma City bombing. There were some compounds in Coeur d'Alene. Were you around during that time?
No, that's when I went up there. So what had happened is my wife actually was diagnosed with breast cancer, and her mother coincidentally was diagnosed at the same time. And so I put in for a hardship transfer with the Marshal Service, and they were originally said, no, we don't do that. But then when they found out what was going on, they allowed me to hardship transfer, and they put me in Coeur d'Alene because my wife's family was from Calgary, Alberta. And so I just asked to be somewhere close to the border. I didn't have any, you know, I didn't say where I wanted to go. So first they put me in Montana before I even picked up stakes to move. They said, no, we're going to open office in Coeur d'Alene, Ruby Ridge, and all that had happened the year before, or 18 months before. And so they wanted to have deputies there, you know, put my kids in school, just be a citizen, you know, show that we're not jackbooted thugs or juggernauts or whatever. And so myself and another deputy opened the office there. There was a courthouse, but it had been closed for quite some time as far as having deputies living there. And so we were the first deputies there for, I don't know, almost a decade maybe. And so we had still the fallout from everything that went on with the Ruby Ridge and all that, and some of the animosity. In fact, my first set of Westerns that I wrote are under the pen name Mark Henry, and that was my fictitious ID in North Idaho. I was Mark Henry when I had to have a credit card or buy gas or whatever, because a lot of places wouldn't sell. You know, when you get in the outlying eras, that you couldn't show them a government card. They didn't want to sell gas to a Fed.
Wow. So, when you first started down in Tejas, down in Texas, how does the Marshal Service work in terms of, like, do you start off doing basic stuff? Like, are you already into fugitive investigations, or do you have to do courthouse security and prisoner transport? What's kind of the graduation process? It's like, you know, with rookies and stuff, you send them, you have them take the easy reports, you work them into stuff. So how does it work with the Marshals?
So I was very fortunate. Since I had law enforcement experience, I got sent to a two-person sub-office in Sherman. I was with a deputy there named John Moore, who had been in the Dallas office and then moved over to Eastern District of Texas. And so it was just me and John. And John was one of the finest, not just finest, finest fugitive hunters, but finest deputies I've ever worked with. Very old school, you know, hat, boots, very former Highway Patrol, Texas Highway Patrol. Talked like an angry Clint Eastwood, yeah. You know, that's Deputy Marshal, you know, that kind of, I just love the guy.
Kill you.
But he taught me, and, you know, I came in with some law enforcement experience, but I was still I wasn't even 30 years old yet when I started, right at 30. And so, but we didn't have, when I started in Sherman, we could put all our prisoners on one 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. And we just didn't have that many prisoners. This was 91. It was pre all the drug, you know, the crack cocaine sentencing guidelines and all that stuff. And so we had court a couple of times a week. The prisoners were right there in Grayson County, but we worked fugitives, and we worked fugitives all the time. In fact, I was, John had to go on assignment because marshals rotate out on special assignment a couple of times a year. And John had to go out on assignment when I was in the office for maybe a week, and he was gone 3 weeks. And I just got with the locals, and we arrested a couple of guys, and, you know, we just hit the ground running. They don't, you know, you get a training, kind of a training senior deputy, but if you know what you're doing, we always kind of joke, they kind of pour a whole can of whip ass on you when you're in FLETC and say, you're deputy United States Marshals, go out and do the job when you get home. And so most of us took that to heart, and we were, So I worked fugitives with John, and then over the, it was kind of inverted from what you just asked, because we worked a ton of fugitives that first year, and then the sentencing guidelines started to change and arrests started to change. And we went from like 19 prisoners to 170 prisoners. And we were keeping them up in Ardmore, Oklahoma, and driving an hour up just to get our prisoners for court in the morning. And then back down, cause we didn't have enough jail space, and over in Denton, which is, you know, over in Collin County. So we were all on the road all the time, and taking prisoners trips up to El Reno, Oklahoma, and which is a, you know, 600 mile or 400 mile, 500 mile round trip from where we were, where the El Reno is where the airlift is based. And in little sedans, so onesies and twosies. But as a writer, you know, I didn't look at that as a bad thing. I'd much rather be out chasing fugitives. But as a writer, I would, you know, get in the, I was the junior deputy, so I had the Shamu, you know, the cage car, the big Caprice Shamu with a cage in it. And we'd put our prisoner, one or two or three, in the back and head off to El Reno and stop and get them a hamburger and a milkshake. And they, you know, they were happy because they got a hamburger and a milkshake. And we were happy because the milkshake put them to sleep. And then we could, but I would chat with them, and, you know, I'd let them know, hey, you know, I'm going to be a writer someday, and tell me about you guys. And they would tell their story. And so I was able to just hours and hours and miles of research. So, but as the crime, I don't think crime changed, but the way we handled it changed, in the border and all of that, our prisoner list just went through the roof. We had to hire another deputy. We had part-time deputies. We had guards in all the time, and it became a lot of court, and then working in fugitives whenever we could. And then when I transferred to Idaho from there after 3 years, there was no sitting judge. And so it was all fugitives. And then once in a while, when we worked court, it was generally because we were a full day's drive away from Boise, where the magistrates were. If we arrested somebody in Coeur d'Alene, we arrested them, got in the car. We tried to arrest them early in the morning. And then we made the day's drive down Highway 95, which is not even interstate. It's just a windy road through the mountains. Did their initial appearance in Boise, spent the night, turned around and came home. So it was, an arrest was a 2 day,
holy cow,
beautiful drive through the mountains of Idaho. But it was a lot of time driving. Yeah.
A friend of mine was retired as a deputy with Ada County, and he ended up doing part-time court security for the marshals up there. I mean, the Sawtooth Mountains is just a beautiful place. Coeur d'Alene, I got to, did some business up there, yeah. Stayed at the resort there. Just beautiful area. But nothing like government efficiency at work. Take 2 days, you know, to do stuff now they do over Zoom or whatever else.
Well, yeah, exactly. We didn't have Zoom, but it was, you know, you have to get them to the nearest magistrate, and that was our nearest magistrate in our district. And it was, I remember we had to drive through some pretty remote areas and big farmland down around Grangeville. And it's, you know, we've got a prisoner who's handcuffed, and you, you know, we have our little stops. We like to vary them so they can go in and go to the bathroom, so we can go to the bathroom. And we had this spot where it was down by Grangeville, I think Grangeville, Idaho, where we would kind of get off the main road, take a cut through some of the farmland. It was just, you know, no fences. It was just fields of, I don't even know what they were growing down there, but like, it wasn't soybeans, but something like that. Just a big field, maybe hay. And, but there was no houses to be seen, no nothing. And this prisoner had been drinking a 7-Eleven Big Gulp, like a Coke, all morning. And we were about 5 hours into the drive. And so we needed to take a leak. So we figured he did too. And we pulled off. And my partner at that time, I had hair and a red, you know, at that time I didn't have a red beard, just a red mustache. But my partner had this humongous black mustache. And he was former special forces and had that look in his eye. And so, and of course we had at this time we were driving Suburbans with our, you know, M4s up front and shotguns and lights and all that and big winches on the front. So we pulled over and I opened up the door and my partner's standing by the door in this just lonely field. And I said, walk out in that field and take a leak. And he said, I'm not going anywhere. I said, no, you got to go to the bathroom. Just walk away from the car and you can take a leak. And he thought that we were going to shoot him. Like he thought that we had taken him out in this onion field to whack him. Yeah. And I said, no, seriously, it's fine. We have to go to the bathroom. He goes, nope, I can hold it till we get to Boise. So he drank like a 44-ounce Big Gulp and held it for like an 8-hour drive because he was afraid we were going to
whack and then
him.
You should have seen the medical bill.
And I mean, I should say his crime that he was accused of was one of those crimes where he was worried about getting whacked in jail. I mean, it's like a crime against a child. So he thought, oh, okay, you know, he felt like he might have it coming. And so his guilty conscience said, I'm not walking away from this car. You guys are going to kill me.
Oh my God. Hey, well, let's dive into a couple of your cases. Cause we want to leave some time here at the end too, to talk about your books and the stuff that you wrote. But when you reflect back on, I mean, how much of the people that you talked to and the cases that you work ended up in your novels?
You know, I think the type of people, I haven't ever based a character off people that we've dealt with, that I've dealt with before, but it's certainly inspired people I've dealt with, and a lot of the goofy stuff and good and bad, you know. I mean, I had a guy that I arrested one time as a fairly young patrolman and a patrol officer, and they were building a new jail. And we had this very old jail with like the old
strap iron,
like regular iron bars that swung and all that. Yeah. And riveted and all that. And it was a very interesting jail, but it was the kind of a jail where, you know, now there's sight and sound separation for males and females and juveniles and all that. But in this particular jail, it was like a big horseshoe with cells on either side and kind of the kitchen right in the middle. And the men were all on like the straight and the curve of the horseshoe, and then the other flat was the few females, so they could hear each other. So you can imagine what it was like back there with men and women prisoners, and what they and just the and they had us work the jail for 2 weeks when we started, just to so we would know what it was like and understand what the county was dealing with and all of that. So I base a lot of, if people read my books, they see there's, because marshals and really all law enforcement are in custodial situations a lot inside, we know, you guys know, what a jail smells like. And to me, this jail smelled like chicken fried steak and flatulence. It was just, they fed them really good, but just farts and fry oil, you know, and despair. So I try to put that kind of stuff in. And then the people I arrested, this guy, I had to take a dog leg out of the way to get to the jail. And I could see him back there kind of squirming in my rearview mirror. And we had, you know, big square screens. I could see them very well. It wasn't, if they wanted to spit on us, they could spit on us. It wasn't like now with a plexiglass, but I could see them squirming. I could see, and then we got kind of further out of the way, and I had to kind of make a big U to get all the way back to the jail. And he started to sob in the back, and he was kind of a jerk. He's kind of a punky kid, but he started to sob. And I said, what's the matter with you? And he goes, how come we're not going to the jail? And I said, we are going to the jail. They're doing some work here. I got to take it back. And he goes, oh man, that's so good. Cause Trooper so-and-so arrested me last week and beat the shit out of me and let me go. And I said, no, we're going to jail. That's all right. So this guy was a fighter. He was a fighter. It was not like somebody just got him and smacked him. He probably fought the guy. And then the trooper was like, you've learned your lesson. Now be on your way. So little whiny guys like that, I've put in the books, you know, people that we had a guy that fought us for, gosh, you guys know how long a fight lasts. Not very long, right? When a fight lasts more than 90 seconds, if somebody says, yeah, I was in a fight, if a fight lasts more than 90 seconds, somebody's probably puking. I mean, it's hard, right? We had a guy that fought us for several minutes, and it was tag team, and it was three of us. And, you know, it's one of those things where, embarrassingly, you try to kick the door and kick the door and kick the door, and it's not opening. And then somebody's got the wise idea to go to the sliding door and back and slide it open and walk in and let you in, kind of a thing. And while all this is going on, we can hear this lady inside, and she's going, help, help, he's killing me, help, he's killing me. And there was this gigantic guy that all of us had arrested five times before. And this was midnight shift, so it was me, my sergeant, and another officer. The sergeant's the one, this is why he made the big money. He's the one that walked around and opened the sliding door while the other two of us are trying, you know, I'll turn backwards and do that donkey kick backwards. And, oh, that's not working. And then all of a sudden it opened and we walked in. Well, we walk in, and the lady who is being beat up is standing over on the wall smoking a cigarette going, help, help, he's killing me, help, help. And nothing, she's just standing there trying to get us to come in. Now, he had smacked her several times, but it wasn't going on while we were, you know, there wasn't an imminent need for us to get in there. And the guy that had smacked her was a big guy. He was probably 6'3", 6'4". And he was in the kitchen making a sandwich. And so we said, let's just talk. You know, we got a wounded woman over here. Let's just talk. And he went berserk. We fought. And he was just wearing a pair of, like, Speedo briefs. And we went to the ground. And we tried to get him, you know, give me your hands. And, you know, guns fell out on the floor. Flashlights were deployed. It was, I mean, and he was smacking us. And there was just this scrum. And, you know, somebody would back off and kind of get a breath and then join back in. And this guy was just throwing us all around, and furniture was breaking. We finally got him handcuffed, took him outside, got him to the car, and then he and the other officer that was there with me is now, he's retired from the FBI. So it's a future marshal, a future FBI agent, and then the sergeant who ended up staying with the PD. And then he started fighting us again. And so we're on the grass, and his drawers came off. So we're like fighting this naked dude on the grass, and it's cold outside and the neighbor's lights are coming on. And so finally I had the bright idea that we needed help. And so I called in, and the day shift was just coming on. So sun was coming up. It was about 6:30 in the morning. They would be going to fall out to get ready to start their day. We were getting ready to end our day. And I got on the radio, and this sergeant who's passed away now, former Marine. I said, Sarge, we got a problem here. He's on the ground. We can't even in the car. He's bloodied. We're, you know, and badges are off. And he goes, how many are there? And I said, well, I listed off. There's three of us. And he goes, look, you catch him, you clean him. And that was it. We were like, all right, I guess I don't know how we're going to do this. And I think the bad guy heard it and was laughing so loud, he just let us put him in the car. But somehow we got him in the car. And it was one of those guys that when we got him to the jail, we all manhandled him in and opened the cell and then threw him in and shut the door with the handcuffs still on him and just kind of let him calm down a bit till we got a bunch more guys. But and the next day I went to the jail for something else. And again, it was that old horseshoe jail. And I was walking back to the back with another prisoner. And he goes, hey, were you on that thing last night? And of course he could tell I was, because I was black and blue. And he goes, man, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I don't know what I was thinking. I was just drunk. Wow. I was like, okay, great. But so I base real fights, real goofy things. I don't particularly like to tell war stories that, you know, if you tell a war story where you look cool in it, nobody believes you. But I got plenty where I don't.
And they're all and true.
I try to put that kind of long. Yeah, I mean, that highway patrolman who we really looked up to, the highway patrol. And again, I was 22, 23 years old. I was sitting at a red light, and the highway patrol officer pulled up next to me, a trooper pulled up next to me in one of those pursuit Mustangs, you know, that they went so fast that the antennas are always bent back from the wind, you know. They're just awesome guys. And I was sitting at a red light, and this trooper who I really respected, he pulled up next to me, and I know you're just recording sound, but he looked over at me, and he gave me a thumbs up. And so I looked over at him, and, you know, we're next to each other at a red light. And I looked over at him, and I smiled, and I thought, oh, he noticed me. I gave him a thumbs up back. And then he gave a slow shake of his head, and then he kind of upped the thumbs up like your lights are on and you're sitting at a red light. And I was like, oh, yeah, sorry. And I'd been on it, you know, stuff like that, that I try to humanize my characters. So, yeah, you can be a badass, but there's going to be some goof-ups too. And that makes – yeah, I think it makes the badassery even more real when – you might have problems at home, or we had a guy that got hired on and he didn't realize that your Sam Brown belt went, and he was a smart guy. I don't know what was going through his mind, but he didn't realize what the keepers were for. So he spent like 40 minutes trying to get the Sam Brown belt through the belt loops of his uniform pants. And he came to work the next day with his belt all like gungied up. You have to put it through one and then put on your handcuffs and then put it through another one and put on your keys and put another one, put on your holster and get it. And we're all looking at him like, I think that same sergeant who said, you catch him, you clean him. I think he took a knife and like touched one of the belt loops and went, and, you know, shot all over the place from
I'm laughing so hard because as a state trooper, that's Kansas Highway Patrol. We had the Sam Browns, and you know, it was like, you had to learn, you know, how to put everything on. It was really nice the way you did that. But yeah, no, it's so funny you mentioned, I got a ride home from a guy. He's passed away, Rodney Bachman, retired as a captain, passed away here about a year ago. But he gave me a ride home one night on a midnight shift. I was really tired. My wife and I had to share a car. She worked at the police department too, so he gave me a ride home. And we had those Caprices, the big whales, you know. And so we pulled into the driveway, and I looked over and said, hey, what's, you know, that guy up there? And I kicked the light switch on, and it was bright, so he couldn't see the lights really above him. He's like, no, I don't see that. So, well, thanks. I thought he would figure it out. So here he is driving down the road, and all these cars are pulling over, and he goes up for about 2 miles going, what are all these cars doing, until they got to a stoplight? And the same thing, one of the people go, look up there. He'd been driving around through downtown, through traffic with his lights on, just fat, dumb, and happy.
I'm sure.
So the next time I asked for a ride, I didn't get one.
No, that's when you look at the other people and say, I meant to do that.
Yeah, I meant to do
exactly. That. Well, yeah, that's what you do when your lights are on and they look at you. You just speed through the light and go on to some fake call somewhere, right?
Drive like hell. Hey, I want to start progressing into talking about your books, but I want to talk about your time on the Marshals. When you look back, what's like one of the most impactful cases or impactful investigations or things that you did? Because when we had Billy Sarukas on, we talked about the DC sniper. You know, just, I mean, you guys do some just fantastic work. You've got some great technology. We talked earlier, Blair Dean, when he used to run the TOG, the Tactical Operations Group, some of the stuff you guys do with phones. And I mean, just amazing stuff. When you look back on it, what's one or two things that just really stick out to you, and you think back and you go, I'm glad, maybe it wasn't the biggest case, but you look at it and you go, that one made a difference. I really like that one. Have you got one or two like that?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's interesting, and I'm actually in the book I'm working on now. I'm making a comparison to, you know, one of the things I really liked about the Marshal Service is you could start your day working with all kinds of tech, especially in Alaska and North Idaho, working with all kinds of technical equipment. Back when I was starting, it was pagers and things like that. So now, and that's kind of a cool thing, is I, in the Clancy books, I could talk about pager technology and all that that we don't really use now, so it's not sensitive anymore. But working with phones and, you know, and computers and all kinds of stuff, and then 2 hours later be tracking somebody boots on the ground through bear country up here, and really have to do it the old way.
Hey players, that is the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, go check us out at Game of Crimes on Twitter, at Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also, go check out our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including our book list. Any book written by our guests will be listed there. In the meantime, go check us out also, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. It's where we put a lot more content you won't hear on our regular podcast. We go into a lot more topics, and folks, it is a lot of fun. So go check us out, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. In the meantime, everybody stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.
New messages.
Hey Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.